Talk given Saturday, 11th August, 1979. Let us deal today with a very important topic. Transcendence, heaven and earth are in timeless conjugation. The Holy One's awareness of this in communion, he translates as world creation. In ancient days, this was spoken of in the common terms of common creatures, exoterically. That is, the language they used was worldly language, as you'll see in a moment. The few learned and discovered the inner meaning. Now, first, this word conjugation. I have deliberately used the word conjugation and not the usual translation by the scholars, copulation. And I'll explain that in a moment as we go on. Now, this is from the Upanishad. Brihadaranyaka, the first chapter, fourth section, third verse. He, referring to the Atma, he verily had no delight. And the word used for delight is reme, not ananda. Therefore, one who is alone has no delight. You remember in the first verse it is stated, in the beginning there was nothing but the Atma, looking around and seeing nothing other than himself, etc., etc. Well, now, he had no delight, but that state where looking around and seeing no other than himself, there is the total consciousness of being as such. The total being, that is associated with ananda, bliss, which is quite a different thing from happiness, pleasure, delight. That state of bliss is a unitary state, a unitary wholeness characterizes it. Therefore, it becomes unanalyzable. Any word we use tends to be misleading. But if we realize, if we clearly see that, then we need not be misled by the word bliss. But here, another word is used, reme, delight. Verily, he had no delight. Therefore, one who is alone has no delight. He desired a second. Notice this word, desired. He desired a second. He was, the Atma was indeed, as large as a woman and a man closely conjoined. You'll find this in all the scriptures which deal with ontology. The whole question of ultimate being, of ultimate things, and so forth. It's very, very difficult to put it into words. But the scriptures have used words because there were disciples who inquired and they recorded the words which were spoken. As large as a man, woman and a man close conjoined, he caused that very being, the conjoined man and woman, to fall into two parts. Now the Sanskrit root of the word fall is pat, P-A-T, pat, into two parts. From that arose pati, usually translated as husband. I have preferred to translate it as the sovereign lord, and Patni, the wife, as the sovereign lady. Therefore, this statement, oneself is like a half fragment, as Yajnavalkya, the great teacher, used to say. Oneself is like a half fragment. Therefore, this void, akasha is the word used, is filled with the feminine. Now, those of you who know your Kabbalah will see most interesting correspondences here. He, the sovereign lord, conjugated with her. Hume and various other translators use the word copulated. Radhakrishnan translates it as became united with her. Therefrom were produced beings with intelligence, manushya, humans. Now note very carefully. He was indeed as large as a woman and a man closely conjoined. And this half fragment, which is the physical part, has the void. He says here, therefore this void, akasha, is filled with the feminine. Now each one of us, as we all know, is composed of a male body and a feminine psyche, or a female body, physical body, and a male psyche, generally speaking. Rarely you find a person, whatever his or her sex is, has both elements in complete balance. That's very, very rare. There is an imbalance. Otherwise, the maleness of the man or the femaleness of the woman doesn't find the normal, usual expression. Now, the Atma caused this, what was a one being, to fall apart. Because they never say, how? One can't talk of these things. If there is a how, it is possibly in this manner. Remember that one starts in the supreme meditative state. There is no separation whatsoever. But as one gradually emerges out of that supreme meditative state, into the other states, which are always what we may call lesser states, less and less conscious in terms of the unitary wholeness, then the oneness becomes a two-ness and a three-ness and an infiniteness, ultimately. You see, the separative process takes place. But in the case of the truly perfected human, the Holy One, the background is always this awareness of the unitary wholeness permeating every separately conscious state. This is what keeps him holy throughout his life. The evil of the world doesn't touch him in that way. So that he becomes the truly sinless one. There is no sundering of the unity of the universe in his total awareness, his total being. This is represented in in India, for instance, the yogi who is always in meditation. And of course, practical people, hard-headed people, or those who pride themselves on being practical, hard-headed people, what's that man doing sitting on his backside, just absolutely lost to the world? They think that he's not very sensible. But they don't know what's happening there. He is not doing anything in our sense of the word doing. Something is happening there, which we know nothing about. So, this represents a person becoming aware of the psyche, first in its perfect state, this has to be carefully remembered, first in its perfect state, then come the proliferations of the psyche, which are the psychical processes. But the psyche as a psyche remains one complete whole all the time, in actual fact. The psyche has no organs like the body has. The body has separate organs, heart, liver, kidneys, and all the rest of it. But the psyche has no such organs. And you see, that is the complement in terms of positive-negative or male-female, which is the invisible part. Hence it's called the void. It's called akasha. Space is one meaning of it, but not space in our specialized, limited sense of the word space, which is necessary for scientific work, for mathematical work and so forth. But this space, akasha, is that which shines. It shines in a darkness. It's a funny thing to say. It refers to things like what the poets mean when they say dark with excessive bright. That's akasha. Its complement is prana, life energy. Not just biologically, but the total life energy. The livingness of the totality. And this void is the sexual complement of the sex of the body itself. Now in the Kabbalah you have this extraordinary teaching. You start with the infinite, Ein Sof. And then you have Chokhmah, the Sephira, which represents wisdom, and Bina, which represents intelligence. Now Bina is presented as the universal mother. When Jesus says, "My mother, the Holy Ghost," as he comes out of his baptism into the Jordan, is the reference to become completely awake to Bina. That universal archetypal form through which primordial creative energy functions. Now the interesting point is this. Chokhmah, wisdom, is presented as male, Bina as female. But this female contains within itself, I'm saying itself, this Bina, this feminine, contains within itself both male and female elements, not yet in interaction, positive and negative energy not yet in interaction. Chokhmah, by mere presence, so stimulates Bina that the male, female, positive, negative interact, and the universe, the manifested universe, comes into being. Now notice what has happened. There is no concupiscence involved in this stimulation by the presence of Chokhmah. There is no concupiscence involved when that positive-negative energy starts up into action and produces the universe. It is, in fact, an immaculate conception. At the divine level, and that which is born out of it is a virgin birth. Now this goes on, here words are difficult, goes on implies time, but this belongs to the context of eternity. It goes on constantly, unceasingly. See? This is the creative process. There is a pulse of creation here all the time. The Immaculate Conception, which releases a virgin birth, means that the unitary wholeness is never touched by any kind of sin. It is the absolute good. There is no evil whatsoever involved in it. And this is the transcendent origin of love in its supreme sense. The stimulation by the Sephira wisdom, which the Kabbalists talked of in terms of the Father in heaven, Abba, Abba, child of the unknown origin. Now you see, this, therefore, this creative activity is a perpetual, implies time, but remember it is eternal. This creative activity is a state of timeless conjugation, transcendence, heaven and earth. It is heaven and earth which represent the activity part. Transcendence is the both the active and the inactive substance, that which stands under and brings all this into being. If I can become fully conscious of this, then all our conflicts, which stem from our short-sightedness, our duality and so forth, just disappear. Pleasure, pain in our physical everyday life, our circumstantial condition, is bound to be present. But we take it in our stride, in mind and consciousness, quite easily. There is no pain involved in it. There is no pleasure involved in it where consciousness is concerned. There is peace, the peace that passes understanding, in the midst of pleasure, in the midst of pain. You see, this is not a philosophy. Because it utterly transcends all philosophy. Every philosophy starts from, rests upon the basis of some intellectual premise or premises. There are no bases at all. See how it is represented in terms of the life of the universe. What does the earth rest upon? What does the sun rest upon? Nothing at all. Free activity through universal space. Free movement. But an ordered movement. A great harmony, an extraordinary thing altogether. So this sort of thing, the teachings of the scriptures, are not a philosophy. They represent, or rather, the word of the scriptures tries to represent a religious being, a religious living. You yourself, actually a fully religious being, and a livingly religious being. That religiousness, that livingness, is what the scriptures try to teach us. This is something which theologians, scholars, and a whole host of them just don't know at all. They really don't. If they hear the words, if they read the words, they may say, yes, there seems to be something in it. And that's as far as they can go. Unless and until there is the purification of the psyche, which means, of course, morality, nothing else. Pure human morality. If that is present, then this livingness, this true beingness, is present, is actually in manifestation. So, let's come back to the statement. Transcendence, heaven and earth are in timeless conjugation. Now you see the meaning of the word conjugation. This, in terms of transcendence, I'm not saying in at the transcendental level, because the moment you use a phrase like that, one thinks of, you know, that sort of something different. But if one uses phrases like in terms of transcendence, then perhaps it is less misleading. The separateness of levels is out of it. Otherwise we are always thinking in terms of the rungs of a ladder which we have to climb to get to heaven. That same ladder, if you climb a ladder to go to heaven, that same ladder takes you into hell also. It is also the ladder to hell. So I should just stay where you are, on square one. And let square one become transformed, transmuted into the infinitude, the eternity, the immortality of transcendence. That's all that's necessary. You don't need to go anywhere. But what an all that is necessary. You see the implications of scripture? The words as they stand are, well, your scholar who is trained to be very logical and sensible says, what nonsense is all this primitive rubbish? He says, these primitive people groping for spirituality. There we are. Now, this thing that verse, he verily had no delight, down to therefrom were produced beings with intelligence. At the cosmical level, these beings are represented in the scriptures as the archangels, the angels, etc. Not only the archangels and the angels, but also the demons and the devils. Because the one represents the building process, the coming into being process, the other represents the transformation of what has come into being into the new thing. That is life in movement, isn't it? But no growth, no movement can take place minus the changing process. When the Buddha pointed out that everything is in constant flux, constant change, amongst the Greeks, Heraclitus, wasn't it, who pointed out this business of the perpetual flux of things. Well, one of those great philosophers did. See, it is also a Buddhist teaching. It is also a teaching through the scriptures. This constant change, this constant flux. But what kind of a change? What kind of a flux? It's a transformative process. The totality of manifestation displays a transformative process. And therefore, the life-death pulse is there. And it is there with such tremendous frequency that you can't count it. This transformative process is something which always spells the new. When your consciousness and my consciousness can, in our limited way, thrill in response to that, be in tune with that, then holiness pervades the psychophysical being, John Smith or Mary Brown or whoever it is. Holiness permeates that person. At the cosmical level, then, the beings are represented in that way. They are not beings like us. The word being naturally makes us think in terms of human beings. You see? We are just one tiny fragment of the manifestation process. But all that is in being is involved in this. And it is there on the universal scale, and it is there also on the infinitely small scale, the particular individual. So, through each and every one of us, as we are, transcendence, heaven and earth are in timeless conjugation. But we, being constituted as we are, have the power to say yea or no with respect to that process. This is our task. Not to say nay to it, that is obvious. And also not to say yea. Because you see, the brain and one's desire nature can very easily be tempted with the heavenly carrot, just as much as it can be tempted by the hellish carrot. This is also temptation. Why? The I am I, separate self, is involved in your consciousness, in it. But when you really see that, and the total being just now vibrates in tune with it, the universal orchestra has no instruments, you and I, that is, who are out of tune with the rest of that universal orchestra. We each play our part, rightly. And we play it naturally and spontaneously. That is the important point. You can't do it in terms of deliberation, deliberately taking sides with it. Because consciousness is split when you take sides with God, just as much as it is split when you take sides with His opposite number. You see, religiousness and humanity has such deep, profound meanings that it is very, very difficult to get into touch with them. This freedom from the opposites, from the pairs of opposites, that freedom is never realized by accepting this and rejecting that. Nor does it mean that one tries to transform that which one sees as evil into what one believes or sees is good. Who is the measurer? Not transcendence. It is me, the finite, limited, ignorant person. You, if not all of you, most of you know the term Jnana Yoga. The yoga through wisdom. You know the word, you know the term Raja Yoga. There is also this Jnana Yoga, which means wisdom in the transcendent sense, the sense of Chokhmah, as in the Kabbalah. In the sense of Mahaprajna, as in Indian terminology, the wisdom gone beyond, as it is called. And when one really touches that, or is touched by that, I should say, when one is really touched by that, all these foolish comparisons disappear. Oh, Raja Yoga is the supreme one, Jnana Yoga is not quite that standard of perfection. Gold medals and silver medals and bronze medals are doled out, you know, by the know-alls. Absolute rubbish. How can you have comparison in terms of the infinite, the eternal, the immortal? A yardstick is something limited. Any yardstick. You can't measure these things. So, through each one of us, there is this continuous conjugation of transcendence, heaven and earth. When one is touched by it and one can thrill in response to it, then one has begun to see truth. Not as something separate from oneself, but one is that. One is conscious of truth in the full, perfect, unknowing sense. Meaning, in the sense where the brain exercises no analytical disruption of that unitary wholeness. Then you naturally are like that. This perhaps is one of the deep meanings involved in that saying in the New Testament, "Allow the little children to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." That naturalness, that spontaneity. The child has the sense of course-ness about it. Of course, this is so. That's that. No argument, no splitting up, no disharmony. It happens. And the universal process is a process which happens. And our speciality lies in our being in harmony with it, although we have the power to resist it, to go against it. But go against it, and there's inevitable sorrow and suffering. Don't call upon God to help you then. He can't. He'd be doing wrong if he did. If what you or I do is fully worked out within my own being, in my own consciousness and awareness, then only this being can thrill in tune with that. Supposing in an orchestra one violinist's one string of one violinist, one violinist's violin is a little bit out of tune. The fellow next to him who is playing cannot stick a finger upon that particular string in order to put it in tune with the rest of the other fellow's violin. Can't be done. And it shouldn't be done, because it is that fellow's business to tune his violin properly. Isn't it you? You see how much is involved in just tiny little bits of scripture. And now, one last point in this connection. This state of conjugation, timeless conjugation, is the primordial marriage made in heaven, transcendentally, universally. In each one of us, the first marriage in heaven consists in the harmonizing of the male and female elements in us. When the male and female elements, that is to say the feminine anima or the masculine anima, is in tune with the male body or the female body, when that harmony is there, then that's the first marriage in heaven without concupiscence involved, being realized through you, the individual, the indivisible. And that again involves, of course, as its basis, morality. When that harmony is there, in any man and woman who are husband and wife, then their marital congress is the correspondence in earth of this divine conjugation in transcendence. And it becomes and is actually a sacrament. That is the meaning of marriage, is a sacrament. If and when human beings can so live that each one of them is a harmonious whole in himself and herself, then the children they produce could well become holy ones themselves. What would be the consequence to the world? Wars, strife, evil, how much of that would prevail? Hardly any. And the solution of all the problems with which man has been faced through the millions of years he's been on this globe, all those would be non-existent. The pleasure element would be out. The reality of bliss would be there. And procreation would be in tune with the pulse of creation itself.